Welcome to the Fullcaster Podcast, episode 45. Our guest today is a special one for me. Known this guy for tick over a decade now or thereabouts, and man, I've been digging to try to get him on the show, and he's in town for Long Beach Grand Prix. Stephen McAleer, going to be running on the streets for the first time. Chat with him a little off air. We're going to get him on here shortly, and to make sure we get as much as possible before he has to get back to the paddock and get some sleep tonight. Let's go ahead and burn through some current events here, Dirk. We've got episode 45 here, about the halfway point of season 3 here on the FCP. Not a lot of time. It's actually been about a week and a half since we just did our recording with Jake Drew.
So yeah, when Pro Tour just happened last weekend.
Right.
Yeah, and now we're approaching LEKC this weekend.
That's right. So yeah, with a close proximity, not a lot you would think has been changing, right, with the current events. We talk about Long Beach Grand Prix. You're going to go to the Grand Prix on Sunday. We have to work through Saturday, but you'll be there on Sunday. And I will actually be getting in the seat for the first, well, I shouldn't say in the seat for the first time, but my first race, if you will, for the first time in about 5 months.
Yeah, quite a while off you had.
Last time I raced was Rock Vegas. Mm-hmm. Been in the seat, a little bit of...
What'd you get, third?
I
wasn't trying to rub
it. Good memory.
You get third at Rock, you're like, oh, I could take some time off.
Forget it. Half a year.
Yeah.
Gonna come back out. I've been on the diet too, so I should be close in the weight department.
Yeah.
At least less fat than I was a little bit before. Matt Johnson liked to point that out during the round table, which, by the way, I'll point out, that was awesome. And that's been getting a lot of cool responses. So thanks everybody for listening to that deal.
We definitely got hit up quite a bit to try to do another one.
Right.
And we want to, we very much do. So we just got to make sure we, do it right, I guess.
Do it right. Like you said, and make sure we have, it's not so much about the right guests, but the right topics and things like that. So we're gonna do that again. I don't know if it's gonna happen this year with the way the schedules are and the way things run out, but maybe in the off season and plug one in for the new year. But regardless, roundtable was awesome. But going back to what we're doing right now, like I said, you're gonna be doing Long Beach. You've been doing that. You've been going to Long Beach Grand Prix since you were a munchkin. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah. So my long story short, my parents, when they first started dating, like that was the thing they did. Had all of his kids, which I'm one of three, and it's been like a yearly tradition for the whole family that we all go. So
some family go to the fair, yours goes to the Grand Prix.
Yeah.
I dig it.
Wasn't much mini fairs around Pedro. So, but yeah, been doing that for a while. So it'll be cool. I'm bummed out because we're going to be talking to Steven in a second, but the IMSA thing, you know, back in the day it was ALMS, and that's always been the coolest part of the weekend is watching that Saturday. So kind of bums me out. I'll be missing it, but still cool being able to see some other stuff on Sunday.
For sure. Yeah. I think they got
something like IndyCar or something like, I don't know. Yeah.
Some other open wheel.
The Atlantics. The Historics are going to be there. That's what I'm excited about.
Is it Atlantics? I think it's like GTP or something like that.
There you go.
It'll be cool. I've only gone once. Obviously, not a native from this area, but when I went, it was pretty cool. Mm. I used to go to the Portland IndyCar race and ALMS as well when it was there. Mm. And yeah, for sure. Sports car shit. That's awesome.
Yeah.
But like we said, I'm going to get also a chance to drive this weekend.
So you're back in the seat, same program with Jim Barry.
Yep, still with old Jimbo. We're going to get out there and just play. We're just doing some test and tune. My season actually starts with the California Rock Championship next month in May. So we're going to just go play around in LAKC, different tire, and all that kind of stuff. But it's just really about getting me back in the seat, shake off some rust. The plan is to go do Tri-C not next week, which is the April race.
You'll do round four.
Yeah, the May race in the very, very beginning of May, which is the same track as CRC. So
yeah, you've done a little bit of coaching, just some, you know, comparison, hopping in some of Jim's driver's carts, but it's just been all the sport cart stuff with you and I, just coaching and all that. So,
which we both know is a big damn difference when you're trying to go out there and run against some of these cats. So that's going to be fun. I don't know who's going to show up for the race this weekend, but the nice thing is I will have a couple of guys under our tent that I can share some data with and play with those guys and have some fun. Like at the end of the day, that's going to be the first race back.
It's going to be a pretty laid back day for you, for sure. You might not even practice on Saturday.
I will. I actually asked Jim.
Begrudgingly.
Like, hey. I'm like, can you get maybe two carts? We'll go run two groups. This is like get more
Jesus
seat time.
Christ.
I could use the exercise anyway. But hey, that's enough about us, man. Like I said, really looking forward to getting Steven on. I've been trying to get him on since we started this thing.
He was
three years ago.
When we started, we had a list of a bunch of people that we wanted to interview. And the people we wanted to interview, we've probably gotten like two of them. And he's the second. So, a few years in the making, but we finally got him here. So.
Yeah, stoked on it. And hopefully, again, this comes out in May. So hopefully it ended well for him.
Yeah,
it wasn't
right.
a curse. But without further ado, let's go ahead and bring him on here. Steven McAleer. Steve McAleer, appreciate you taking the time here. You're actually in town doing a race, and I'm like, hey, you got anything else going on this weekend? Maybe you pop over here, and you're like, for sure. And I appreciate it, man. It's awesome getting you on.
Yeah, no, thanks a lot for having me, guys. It's been 9 years since I've been here.
Right, yeah. And that's the last time you were here. I said in the intro there, I'd known you in the neighborhood of 10 years or so. The last time you were here at CalSpeed was for the 2013 Sport Kart Grand Nationals, basically the national championship for sport karting, for arrive and drive karting that we used to run here at CalSpeed. And you came out and played, and not only played, but won the bloody thing. And
skipped town right after that.
Yeah,
never
haven't
saw
seen
him again.
Since. Yeah. He's like, just kidding, see ya. Before we get into what you do for a living, all those other kinds of stuff, How did you hear about this and the sport karting stuff coming out here? Again, we talk about you just been out here 9 years ago and coming back here. What was it like, actually, I should say, ask that question. Pulling up to the Speedway here at Auto Club, rolling in here, first time here for 9 years. You kind of, oh, man, I remember this from a while back.
Yeah, I mean, I did stop at the gate and I was a little lost. The guy said, do you know where you're going? I said, no, I'm looking for Mike Smith. And Mike Smith shows up behind me in his rental car or his personal car. I'm like, oh, he's right behind me. I'll just follow him. So, you know, it's cool. You know, driving by the racetrack, again, I'd love to be here a lot more. My schedule doesn't allow it. But again, super excited to be back and say hello to you guys.
Yeah, it's awesome having you on here. And we'll talk about more about what we did there a few years back with the arrive and drive stuff. But let's dig into, like I said, Long Beach Grand Prix this weekend, which means so we're on the same page. You're not on. You're not doing the crew thing. You're a driver. You get behind the wheel and you're putting time in. Correct me if I'm wrong. First time also around the streets of Long Beach this weekend.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a big year for me. It's my first season in IMSA GTD, and we're coming off a couple of good results. We've had a third place at the Rolex 24 back in January. Finished second at the Sebring 12-hour, and you know, coming to Long Beach, never been here before. The track is massively tighter than I thought, and just the added pressure, we're leading the championship in GTD, so let's go out there and see what we got tomorrow.
You're not exactly in the smallest car either. That Mercedes looks pretty bulky.
The Mercedes is, I mean, I think everybody looking at that last corner, that last hairpin, I was watching a couple of videos online, I ain't going through there 2x2. Let's say that. Inside or outside, it's not going to work.
I remember watching F1 in the, I think it was the 90s, where they had special steering racks that they would put in the F1 cars to get around Monaco for the hairpin there, Lowe's or whatever it was called, the hairpin. Do you guys do anything special just to get around? Because I can't think of another IMSA track or even, I mean, really anything outside of maybe Sonoma's turn 11 for the cup guys and whatnot that's that tight.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, after walking the track today, and, you know, there's a couple of tracks on my racing schedule this year that I have not been to, but, yeah, I don't think anything is going to be as tight as, you know, that last corner. You know, the Mercedes is a big car. The turning circle is terrible. The car is amazing. I can't, praise it. The thing is absolutely fantastic, but it's going to be tough through there. I'd like to say the guys have done some setup stuff to make it turn, but it's going to be how much I can turn the steering wheel in there is going to get us around that last corner.
Yeah, it's made to go racing on, maybe a proper track, that kind of thing. Maybe
right.
Not the Walmart parking lot we got.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've got a car when you look at it now. I mean, there's so much aero involved. You know, you see the diffuser, the front splitter, all the clever Aero in the car, and well, that doesn't work at 26 mile an hour in the hairpin. Yeah. So I've got a big boat that I need to figure out to get through there.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's crazy. And before you came out here, I know you were doing a track walk. We've talked about track walks on the show with karting stuff. And obviously, this being a karting podcast, we will absolutely get into more of that. But when you're doing a track walk with the car stuff, and to that point, a track you have not been on, what's your approach on track walks? What are you looking for? Is it sight lines? Is it markers? Are you looking at the surface itself?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this car, we're going plenty fast down the straights now, where the brake boards have to be. You know, I really spend time looking at the brake boards, and you know, a lot of the go kart and stuff growing up, there's a lot of corners that I like to say is a feel corner. It's a corner that there's no real reference when you turn, when you brake, when you do all your stuff in there. And this track will probably have a few of those turns. But I'm very careful on the approach, especially with the big high speeds into, you know, 30, 40, 50 mile an hour corners. It's interesting you bring up the track walk. The Oakland Valley Race Park go-kart schools that I do every year, I do 4 or 5 schools at the local track up in New York, and every single morning we do a track walk. And, you know, I show the kids the line, the brake points, when we're turning, but the stuff that I love, and we'll certainly see it at Long Beach here, you know, you stand at the apex and you kick your feet on the surface and you feel the grip if there's some rubber down.
Right.
Well, keep kicking your feet and walk away from the line and you can feel the difference. You know, once you get one car length or two car lengths off the apex, you start noticing that, you know, it's a lot slicker out there. So that's my biggest thing with the kids is teaching them this. And when they don't listen, they go where I told them not to, and which is usually into red and white barrier system, and I go back and pick them up.
They learn the hard way.
hopefully I don't do that this weekend with a bigger car.
Well, paying attention to your social media, knowing that you've just done, whether it be a practice day or what have you, just recently, you had snow.
Oh, yeah.
You're not going to worry about that this weekend.
Yeah, New York is a joke. I'm driving here, and I thought the thing in the car was broken. It showed 104 degrees. That's not a real number to me. We're seeing 25 and 30 back home right now. So it's the climate change is hilarious, you know, coming from Florida. Then, you know, we moved to the West Coast for a couple of races and we'll work our way back. And, you know, you can never bank on it being hot, cold, sunny, rain. Yeah. Everyone's in the same boat.
You talk about being in the GTD and it being your first season. Are you considered a, quote, full-time driver? Like, is that the 9-to-5 for you? What's paying the bills?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm, you know, I'm very fortunate. I've been working hard for a long time since I came to the States, and you know, there's a number of race teams that I drive for now. The Mercedes team, you know, there's 12 races over the course of the season, so I look at that as 12 race weekends. My main thing that I've been working on for a long time is with Joe Robillard in the LMP3 car. Again, one of my favorite cars. The LMP3 car would not go through that last corner particularly well. Break your teeth on the bumps as well. That's 5 weekends. Then I have the IMSA GT4 platform. It's a team called RS1 that I drive for. There are 10 races in the Michelin Pilot Challenge. And honestly, I could go on. I mean, there's so many good things happening this year. I've got another opportunity in SRO. But a lot of these weekends, I'll drive 2 or 3 cars the same weekend.
Oh, really?
So when we go to VIR in August, I will have the Mercedes duties, the LMP3 duties, the Porsche Cayman GT4 duties, and then just to add in there, my MX5 Cup team, McCombie McLaren Racing is there as well, and I'll coach 7 drivers. And literally, it's I get my schedule and I highlight where I'm going and where I have to be, and there's a 30-second window between when I have to be off track and on track.
So wow. On those weekends, it is jam-packed and nonstop.
It's busy, and obviously, you know, these teams have brought me on board for a reason. I'm in there to win races and hopefully win the championship. And I always want to make sure that I put my best effort in, as we all say, but I'm driving very, very different cars. So one of the biggest things that I try and do is a quick refresh is, where am I braking in the Mercedes related to the GT4 car?
Yeah.
The LMP3 car has no ABS, very easy to go, you know, press the brake pedal and go flying off the racetrack if, you know, you're used to the ABS. So I really try and pick on the breakpoints, and that's my kind of quick recap before I jump in the car. Okay, this car can break half a board later than the other one, and then away we go.
And I'll tell you what, I remember last year going to Phoenix for the first time, and I was running the 100cc as well as the Rock GP, the 125. And in a couple of spots, there's a pretty stark difference in your speed, even though the GP actually had a rev limiter and the 100cc does not. And they all have the same rubber, so the grip was the same. The speed that we were carrying in some of the corners was different. And trying to make that quick adjustment, I've always said that I'd almost rather go fast to slow than slow to fast, because I always felt like I'd either underdrive or overdrive if it was the other way around. Is there a particular way that, not like you have a bloody choice, but
I was gonna say,
come out and say you were doing an MX5 or something like that for the reason you jump into like LMP or something with all the downforce?
Well, it's interesting you say that. So I grew up on the obviously the go-kart and stuff, and then I got an opportunity with Mazda around similar time when I was over here for Cowspeed Grand Nationals, so call it 2012-2013. And there's obviously a lot to take away, saying you can drive, if you can drive a slow car fast, you can drive anything fast. And you know, really what they mean on that is there's a lot of momentum involved. I think the go-karts that you guys have here that we ran for the Cowspeed Grand Nationals, it's the same deal. It's all momentum. You're carrying as much speed as you can, keeping the RPM up. But you brought up a good point. You can't jump out an MX-5 and jump straight in an LMP3 car and think you know what you're doing, because it's going to end up one direction and one direction only. So, as I've been going through these last couple of years, it is actually easier for me to jump out the faster car and jump in the slow car, because I feel like I'm an absolute nutcase in it and I can brake wherever I want and do whatever I want. And really, that's just because everything's happened much slower. You know,
right.
I have more time to
your
adjust
the autopilot's a lot. It's just that much more precise on the slower stuff.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And you know, last year, it almost hurt me a few times. I came out of the LMP3 car. I was in the Lamborghini Super Trofeo driving that as well. And then I jump into the Aston Martin GT4 car that I was running all on the same weekend, VIR again. My birthday weekend, so it's a great present for me. And I was coming up through the S's at VIR, and you do a little lift in turn 9, and then you do a brake in turn 10. With the LMP3 car, you don't do a brake in turn 10. You lift and you turn in and, you know, you let the aero work its magic. Well, I was trying to do this with the Aston Martin for like multiple laps in a row. I was like, why is this bloody thing not going to turn? And I just needed to come back a step. I mean, it was out of control from turning all the way to the exit curb. And then a car got past me and I was like, oh, he's braking. he's braking. Maybe I'll press the brake. So all of a sudden I was like, okay, all right. Jesus Christ, Stephen.
That's got to be some pressure, though. I mean, because the teams are having the faith in you to go out there and do the job, but they're seeing you hop in every car, I'm sure, right? I mean,
and they're going into it knowing that you're doing this already, I would think, too, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I tell them, you know, I'm going to be running one, two, or three cars, and none of these are factory programs. You know, I'm not a factory Mercedes guy. I'm not a factory Porsche guy. If that was the case, then the multiple classes I wouldn't be able to do. I'd be, you know,
right,
stuck with that one manufacturer, which would also be fine. So, you know, one of the things that I really try and give my best is make sure that each team has equal time off of my time. Especially if we've got a car that's not handling well, or we have an issue and we need to get it, you know, get some setup stuff done. It doesn't look good if I jump out the car and then disappear and go drive something else.
Right, right.
So yeah. The nice thing with the Mercedes here, my teammate Mike Skeen, he was a guy that I competed against in LMP3 a couple of years ago. Fantastic driver, been around a long time. And, you know, we share very similar feedback with this car. So that helps if one of us is, and he also does other stuff as well. So you know, making sure the car's right, but spending the right amount of time there with the team.
And that's got to be hugely important to the team, just having never mind the confidence in your ability, but like you said, knowing that they're not second fiddle to anybody else.
Yeah, right.
100%. I mean, in all honesty, my primary is the LMP3 cars with Joe Robillard. You know, Joe has had given me an opportunity a few years ago, came out the Mazda ranks in 16, and he asked me if I wanted to drive a Porsche Cayman GT4 and move away from the Mazda ladder system that I was on. And I wouldn't have said I thought I was stuck. I mean, I was in the car every year, very fortunate that I was getting a paycheck to drive a race car. Not many people can say that they do that. But I wanted to drive a Porsche. I was like, let me go play with this Cayman.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that turned into the LMP3 ride. And, you know, he's been so good for me. And in all honesty, the reason I'm in the Mercedes is because of the opportunity I got in the LMP3 car with him. The owner of this Mercedes team recognized me in the P3 class because I was competing against their guys and said, well, why don't we have these guys team up, not race against each other? And here we are in the Mercedes.
Rock and roll.
I'm sure, too, for the MX-5 stuff, like, there's a decent amount of carters I've seen, you know, younger guys go from karting to the MX-5 Cup pretty quickly. But there's also, you know, the older guys like yourself too, that are either doing it to stay sharp or doing it because they really like it, whatever the case may be. But with a class like that, is it easy to get stuck there, if you will?
So, you know, Mazda, so going back to, you know, so I won it, Mazda MX-5 Cup in 2012. And that got me the budget, which I think was $200,000. The price was $200,000 for Mazda. And I could pick any Continental Tire Series team at the time. And there was three teams. There was CJ Wilson Racing, which is the team that I ended up with. iMoto, which was a Mazda Speed 3 at the time. And Freedom Autosports, which was the other Mazda team. And so there was a jump from MX-5 Cup. There was a next step.
Mm.
When TCR came out, you have the Hyundais, you have the Audis, you have the Hondas, and Mazda had been working for quite some time trying to get this Mazda TCR program up and running, and it's been on hold. You know, it's not moved forward. So I wouldn't say the guys in MX-5 Cup are stuck. There's just such a big budget difference to go from an MX-5 program to GT4 now.
Yeah.
I mean, the numbers for GT4 would scare you. I mean, they're up at $1 million now for a good team in IMSA GT4 to run the car for the season.
You see the number, you're like, I'm having a lot of fun in MX-5. Like, I might think twice about this.
And we just talked about that in the roundtable, didn't we? We
talked about moving up the ladder.
The gap from arrive and drive, just a 206 being a decent jump. And then you go from 206 to, let's call it the entry-level two-stroke, 100cc stuff, mm-hmm. like that first level, and that's another bump right there. And they're not like it's double or it's more than that. And in what you're saying it too, from like Miatas, what have you, or MX-5s up, it's considerably more than double.
No, it is. When I, so my go-karting team that we have based in Oakland Valley, you know, we are fortunate enough that the track owner allows Rotex and Ayami X30 to run together.
Nice. Like old, you know, tag days, yeah.
Yeah, so they'll change the header on the X30, 26, 29, depending on kind of where the performances are. Well, at one point it was all Rotex. I mean, Mike, you doing Florida Winter Tour, there was a full Rotex class down there. There was 30, 40, 50 seniors, semi juniors, Micro Max, Mini Max. Well, that's kind of disappeared now, and it was unfortunate because the Rotex is such a good engine program in terms of, I like to call it, low budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
We don't really see a performance loss with these things up to 25 to 30 hours, whereas my customers on the X30 Miami stuff, if they want the right stuff, I mean, we're 7-8 hours before a rebuild.
Yeah.
Well, we do an hour and a half at the racetrack each time. So what is that? 5, 6, 7 days, and then it needs to be sent away for a rebuild. So significant cost difference when you start looking at it like that. And that's kind of where, you know, MX-5 Cup is amazing. It just got move to the, you know, the IMSA calendar now. So they're racing at some really cool racetracks over Daytona. I'd like to see Sebring back on there. And a lot of big tracks on the schedule, and the prize is bigger. I mean, there's really good reasons to be an MX-5 Cup, not to mention the racing is insane.
Right.
But as you guys mentioned, there's a lot of the kids coming up. I have two or three of them on my team that are absolutely fantastic. They're looking for that next step. Obviously GT4, seems to be one of the bigger categories over here in the States right now. So IMSA's maybe a little stretch in terms of dollar amounts, but there is stuff in other platforms that you can run those cars.
We talk about the you know, karting and Dakars and stuff like that. And that's kind of, I mean, the perfect segue here. I want to go back to little Steven, like how you got started as a munchkin way back in the day. Did you, like, tell us about the early days. Did you kart as a little kid and how did that go, or how'd you get started in racing?
So it's interesting. So you said little kid, but in all reality, like, I didn't start go-kart racing at all until I was 12. And we all know that that's actually late compared to what you're seeing nowadays. You know, we have a six-year-old on my team. You know, he drives around the racetrack, no fear. But he's 6 years ahead of me, if you want to look at it.
Right.
From I'm in trouble, you know. So I, huge fan of racing, and every birthday party I had from eight up was a go-kart birthday party of some sort.
And just so we're on the same page, this is not in New York.
This is in Glasgow, Scotland. It's this weird accent that I have. So, you know, we would go go-kart racing, and I mean, I...
They thought you're from the Midwest this whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. Or England.
Yeah.
England.
Yeah. Like, this guy's not American.
Yeah. I'm trying to keep the Scottish accent. It's actually faded quite a lot, I think.
It has?
Yeah.
It has.
It's not good.
You almost sound like me.
It's not good. If I have a drink, it'll come right back.
Oh, there we go.
So my dad bought me a go-kart when I was 12, ran around, and I actually laughed. Like, I wasn't very good. I mean, I would run around at the back of a field of 30, 40.
What were you driving as a kid? 12 years old. So, yeah.
We were juniors, but it was called Formula TKM at the time, which was 100cc.
Okay.
Similar to the Yamaha in some cases. So, yeah, I'd run around at the back, and I had a blast. Like, I loved it. You know, I'd beat somebody that was really good, but told all my friends I'd beat him. Never told anyone his chain fell off and he never made lap two. You know, I was like, I beat that guy. You know, he sorted him out. And I think I was 14, 13 or 14. The Scottish Championships were coming up at a racetrack called Crail, up next to St. Andrews. You guys play golf. St. Andrews, very famous golf course up there. And my dad had been persuaded by a bunch of people to say, listen, this is great experience. Take him. He has zero chance of winning this. Take him and let him experience it. So I went out, getting my ass kicked left, right, and center. And in the second heat, I believe it was the second heat, it was a high-speed left-hand corner, which is basically the start of the race, you know, the two-by-two formation. And a cart pulled out to the right-hand side, and there was somebody in front of me, stopped. And I hit him full speed. Flipped upside down, broke a bunch of bones.
That was a good experience, yeah.
Stop breathing. Oh, tongue rolled up. Oh, yeah, it was a bit of a mess.
Oh, man. Wow.
My mom was standing there with one of my other brothers, and she says that she threw my brother on the grass to try and jump over the fence. It was a fairly significant accident, and what ended up happening was the go-kart had hit me on the back. You know, when I had to get thrown out, the rear chassis legs had hit me on the back. So I stopped breathing for a little while. So, mom and dad, you're done. That's us
really?
Done racing. Oh, yeah.
No, that's not fair.
That lasted
one for, little tiny little wreck. Yeah.
Yeah. That lasted for about an hour with my dad. And he's like, okay, let me work on my mom. We'll see if we get her back in here.
But before you keep going on that, did he race as a kid? Is motorsports in the family?
It's always been in family. He used to do what we call sprints and hill climbs back over in Scotland, which was a time trial thing.
Okay. And more rally, that kind of deal?
Yeah, it was like a tarmac stage, but I mean, he had a Ford Fiesta, not a Ford Festiva, what you guys get over here, whatever that thing is, but a Ford Fiesta.
We got Fiestas,
and we'd have a blast. You know, the car wasn't fast, and he'd drive around, but we'd go watch him, and we'd love it. So, the junior car that I had got destroyed, and my dad had already ordered another one for me prior to this accident. So he started driving. So he moved up. He moved into the senior class, and he was running seniors, and it was hilarious.
I mean, was he racing at the same time when you were racing?
No.
Beforehand?
No, it was.
This is just a very convenient opportunity.
That was his excuse to get back out on the track. So, you know, he'd run seniors, and fast forward, I don't know, 9, 10, 11 months down the line, we were racing at a track up in Aberdeen, and I would go to every race with him, even though I wasn't racing. I mean, I broke my collarbone, bunch of ribs. I mean, it was a pretty bad one. But I was feeling better, and I was like, Banff is called B-A-N-F-F, Banff. It was the favorite track in Scotland by a mile. And we got there, and it's snowing every day of the week up there.
Oh, wow.
And I looked at the entry form. I was like, hey, Dad, I was like, I could smoke these guys. And he's like, yeah, you think so? I was like, yeah, look, this guy's garbage. He's rubbish. And I was just looking for an excuse to try and get in it. Well, he hadn't told me that he'd brought all my gear, and I was on the entry list, and he wasn't driving, and that was my first race back after an accident. Wow. And
did mom know?
She did. Yeah, she knew. Yeah, brilliant. So that was cool. So, and but the crazy thing is I mean, I laugh. Like, I truly believe I wasn't particularly good behind the wheel. And that first event back, I demolished the whole field and drove away from everybody. I like some good guys in the race. And ever since then, that was me hooked. That was the so it's something happened, and you know, my dad laughs. He's like, "Well, you had brain damage before then, so it doesn't make any difference if you have get more brain damage." But it was clearly a fear related thing that all of a sudden I'm like, "Okay, well, let's get rid of the fear part."
You already know the worst that can happen.
Yeah,
yeah. I wonder if part of it too. I mean, how many? Your dad was racing for what, 8 months or so in that time that you're off. Maybe vicariously too. I mean, we see it all the time out here. Little kids just hanging around the team that are driving, and they don't know any better, but they're out there, and then they're in between the sessions, they're listening to people talk, like, and watching.
That definitely goes, and that was what was happening. I mean, yeah. I was watching him in the seniors, but I was studying the juniors. I was looking at the four or five guys that I remember their names that were amazing up front. Well, I wasn't watching them to see who would win the race. I was trying to learn something as well. So I'm sure that was all part of it. Again, watching my dad and learning from him. And obviously I was appreciative that they put me back in it.
And you didn't have any trepidation out of the gate. Like, obviously you had the confidence, or at least as you were saying, like, no, like trying to convince them, I definitely can kill these guys. I should be able to do this. Once you got the opportunity, you found out that actually, kid, you're actually in the seat here. Was there any kind of, oh, shit, all right, I now have to back this up, or was it go time?
You know, that was 25 years ago, so I can't remember, but I'm sure I was like, oh, I better, what I just spoke, I better get on it.
Yeah.
If I want to have another race.
Yeah, where's my suit, Dad? You never brought my suit. No, I brought your suit. It's in the back of the truck. So, but I hadn't had any practice. I was out for first practice session, whatever it was, Friday or whatnot. And, yeah, I was like, oh, thing feels quite good, and rest is history.
So you end up having this stellar comeback from the accident, most of a year off, if you will, to heal up, and then you get back and the seat goes well. At that point, you said you were hooked. What was the thought process as a, at that time, 14, I believe you said, 14-year-old kid working on 15? Was it always like, okay, I always wanted to be a race car driver, or did that spark something? No, or was it at that point just, no, I would like to go karting some more?
No, I always wanted to be a race car driver from 5 or 6. I mean, that part has never changed. And again, as lucky to get back in the seat, and as you hear hundreds and thousands of stories, you know, my mom and dad ran out of money. You know, we were super low budget. We didn't have a new set of tires each weekend. And some of the bigger events where it was 2 or 3 days, my dad being self-employed had to, you know, take 3 days off work and park the truck up. And, you know, it got tough, and it's the same, you know, 15, 16 years old. All right, well, we're out of money. What do we do now? And I think that's the part where, and don't get me wrong, it's not a case that you can get to the top easily, but that's the case where most people give up when it becomes that, you know. Well, my mom and dad had no money. This kid's in it because he's, you know, dad's paying X amount of millions of dollars. And there's still options, and I'd like to think I'm a good example of somebody that did truly come from nothing. And, you know, here we are racing 35 weekends out of the year in, you know, the biggest races in America.
Not too shabby, I suppose.
Not too shabby.
Well, there's a bit of stuff in between then and now. So you as you say, you run out of money. Yeah. Is there a full stop in the karting deal? Or like you said, there's still options. How did you keep going? And what was the step ladder from there as you're now becoming a young adult?
So there was a couple of scholarships at the time, similar to what you see over here. You know, there was some scholarships popping up. One was actually called BeARacingDriver.com.
I think I remember that, actually.
And it's got your ring to it.
Yeah. Be a race car driver. And it was a series of... call it elimination. One was a go-karting round, one was a fitness round, and then the guys that they, you know, thought were half decent moved into the car stages, and we drove a Mini Cooper. And the prize for the winner was a full season in the British Renault Clio Cup Championship, which was those front-wheel drive British Renault Clio, amazing little cars, which was the feeder level for British student cars. Well,
oh, cool.
I wanted to be in the British Touring Car Championship. I wanted, sadly, to drive the Renault Laguna and be in BTCC. And anyway, so I entered the scholarship. Didn't cost much at all. £300 maybe to enter it, but there was, you know, a significant amount of participants. And I won the scholarship.
Oh, wow.
And when we were announcing, or so the scholarship was run by a guy called Tim Sugden. Tim Sugden was, drove British Touring Car Championship, drove a McLaren F1 at Le Mans, you know, really good background. So the scholarship to me looked legit. I'm like, sure, let's try and see what we can get. Well, during the scholarship final, they announced, I think I'm going to British Renault Clio Cup. The previous scholarship winner had caused so much damage to the car in the previous season that supposedly the scholarship lost money. So they changed the price. They said, nope, you're not racing British Renault Clio Cup. We're going to send you over to America. So this was 06 at the time, 2006.
How old were you in 06? Sorry?
22. Okay. So yeah, that's a good... So there was a 4 or 5 year window where, you know, I was training in a go-kart, but I wasn't doing anything.
So properly done?
Yeah. I mean, like trying to figure out every possible way and if I could get in something, if I could drive a car at some point.
Were you just working and just paying for yourself at that point?
Yeah, I was doing like crazy hours. I used to work at TK Maxx, which is TJ Maxx over here.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Hilarious times in there. There's a quick story there. I was stockroom supervisor. So I was the big shot.
And you moved up quick, didn't you?
I was a real deal.
He was the only guy back there, though. Well, manage yourself, kid.
But it actually gets better. So I was stockroom supervisor. I supervised two people, my two brothers.
Oh, wow.
The three. Yeah, yeah. It was an absolute riot. They had a guy in there, you know, security, you know, looking for people stealing and whatnot. And he came in the stockroom one day and he said, "Steven, come here. I need to chat with you." I'm like, oh God, I hope one of my brothers didn't steal something.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to fire my brother. It's going to be a brawl outside. And he brings me in to the security and he's got all these cameras up. He says, "What the F is this?" I said, "Oh yeah. Well, we had placed like little figures all over the cameras and all the cameras had a little action figure on all the cameras and they were blocking the whole view." I was like, "Can I get a picture of that? That looks amazing." So that's a quick story.
That's awesome. That's what you aspire to.
Yeah.
You too can be a stockroom manager.
That's not. I was the best. I could do that pilot truck faster than anybody else.
That was the training.
That was it.
You got the training in
there. That was it.
That's really the route to the top.
Yep. So, anyway, I won the scholarship in 05, and then I came to the States in 06. It was a fully funded season in the Skip Barber Open Wheel Regional Championships.
You know what's interesting about that? First thing that pops in my head, hey, you know what?
We can't afford this.
Yeah. But it's cheaper to send you over to the States. Now, I suppose they didn't, like, you got to figure out your lodging. You got to figure out all that kind of junk, but they gave you the ride.
Everything was paid for.
Get out. Wow. And that was cheaper than putting you in the bloody, oh my gosh.
By a lot.
Yep. That guy must have done a number to the car then.
I mean,
there was no car left.
We could send him to the estates four times and still die.
Is that Skip Barber series? The national, like the school series kind of deal?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's when that was booming. So I ran it in 06 and finished second.
Were you kind of bummed out though that was where it took you? Like, I don't think you're bummed out that you got a free ride, but you're like, really wanted the British tour.
I mean,
stuff.
That's actually a good point. And like, I was, because all the training for the last four rounds was in a front wheel drive Mini Cooper.
Oh, wow.
Because they were training you for a front wheel drive Renault Clio. Well, now I'm over here driving an open wheel rear wheel drive car.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that training went, that was real good there, you know.
Never mind, the tracks are a little bit different, things like that too, right?
Yeah. But, you know, once I come over here, I mean, I was laughing at, flew in to Orlando with my mom and I rented I remember this like it was yesterday, a white Chevy Monte Carlo. And I was so excited that it had two exhaust pipes sticking at the back. I'd never seen that. You know, Scotland, you've got a pea shooter of an exhaust. You know? This had two exhausts.
It was still a V6.
Still a V6. Let's be honest, it was absolute garbage. But
this is the American muscle I've been hearing about.
Yeah. This thing's quiet. So I did my 2D advanced school at Sebring.
Oh, cool.
And really, that's kind of how it took off. I ran 06, ran the Skip Barber Nationals in 07, finished fourth. And just to make you laugh, so some of the drivers that were in it. So Joel Miller won the championship. Oh, he's a California boy. He's
big
over
time
here.
Carter, yeah. And then moved on, yeah.
Ricky Taylor was
okay.
P2. Oh,
okay. He's done some stuff.
Done some, yeah. He's he might be here this weekend.
Yeah.
AJ Riley was third. Connecticut kid, I was fourth. And then the guys behind us, Joseph Newgarden, Gabby Chavez.
Never heard of him.
Yeah, I mean, there was some big names in it. You know, it was cool because these kids were significantly younger than me. I mean, I was over here 24, 25 years old. And yeah. These kids were 13, teens. 14.
Right. Straight in it. Maybe still in karts actually at that time.
Probably,
yeah. Newgarden, those guys, yeah.
Yep, they were doing the, at Newgarden, I think, was doing the Robo Pong stuff.
Exactly
Newcastle,
that, yeah.
All that stuff. So, and I hadn't really spent a huge amount of time. I mean, I knew what the Rolex 24 was. I know what the Sebring 12 are, but I hadn't studied to see who was, you know, the next up and coming guys in the States. And in all honesty, I mean, there was a massive amount of them were in Conor DeFilippi. I mean, there were some big names in that year. So I ran in 07, ran in 08. And between those 3 years, I found enough connections that they said, listen, maybe we can bring you over to America.
How did you continue? I would assume that the sponsorship was a 1 year or one season deal. Oh,
yeah, good point. So the scholarship owner had said that he had never had someone be so successful in their opening year. And he funded a second year because he wanted to, first of all, see how far I could get. But two, in all honesty, it was helping him on the scholarship that, you know, if he's got a name out there that's moving up the ranks. And they have another big name that went through it, Rob Huff.
Okay.
World touring car stuff. So, I mean, he's obviously been super successful. And again, met a couple of contacts, and that's how the whole Grand Prix New York thing happened, the indoor facility in Mount Kisco, New York.
So how did that happen?
Before that, you're doing 3 years of Skip Barber, all in the Formula car?
All in the Formula car.
6, 7, 8. Yep. 2016.
Okay, so you get the second year funded for, but what are you doing in between the time at the track? Are you doing anything in motorsports as far as working or
flying back and supervising two brothers at TJ Maxx?
So oh wow!
So you were
that's
really
the life of a race car driver.
It is,
yeah. Man.
Jet setter.
Yeah. That's like, awesome.
Not just a storeroom. No, I'm a race car driver. Yeah, I race over in the States. You might have heard of me.
It went from being little figurines in the camera to pictures of himself. Like just.
Yeah. That's the next level. Yeah. Right there. Yeah. Oh man.
Yes, so, I mean, but those years were tough because you know I did see the cost of what it would cost for an event,
right.
And you know the moment that the sponsor was gonna say we're done with that. It's not buying a set of tires for a go-kart anymore. It's a number that's unrealistic, certainly for, you know, for our background. But I'd found a couple of contacts. I started to almost coach some of the guys. So in Skip Barber days, there was two classes. There was the regional class and the sportsman class. And sportsman was like beginner. And regional was a little bit more experienced. And then obviously the national, which was on the other level. Well, the guys that I had been friendly with in 05 and 06 when I'd came over here, one of them, Cy, owned the Mount Kisco Grand Prix New York. And he said, listen, he's like, I don't know what you're doing. I love your coaching. Are you interested in coming over? You could come over here and be the indoor go-karting coach. I'm like, well, I don't want to be stuck there the rest of my life, but here's my shot. You know, come over to the States. I'll live in New York. And that's what I did. So I moved over here permanently March 2009. And I'll be honest, it was a big awakening for me. I mean, I got over here, stayed with a good friend of mine. Well, now you get into the really tough stuff. No bed.
Yeah.
You know, no car, no social security, no phone, mm-hmm. no license. I was like, ooh.
This starting is, all over
here
again.
Here we go again. So I was 24. But I wanted this more than anything else. And I think this is why my accent's messed up now. So, I mean, I would be a chief instructor at the go-kart track. So I would run competition events, private instruction, the leagues. And I asked, I was like, hey guys, you're not paying me enough money. Like I got to give me some more responsibilities. And they said, well, why don't you take charge of the sales for all the events that you're doing? So sell your 12-hour race, sell your 6-hour race. And That's why the accent's messed up, because when you're talking to people on the phone, they have no idea what I was talking about at all. We actually had a
This race is where?
Yeah. We actually had a customer call the front desk one time, and the front desk girl comes on and says, "Hey, Stephen, there's somebody on the phone. They're looking for the Arabian race car driver." I said, "Arabian?" Yeah. Well, I'm the only person with an accent in this whole building. It's Scottish, maybe? So she went back out and he was like, "Oh, yeah, Scottish. Yeah, Scottish. Jesus. So I was the Arabian race car driver.
That is American in a nutshell. Whoever accent. Something outside this country.
As melting pot as New York is, that's the one they left
right.
out.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest, I had such a good time there. I obviously learned a lot, you know, eventually bumped into you guys because of all the indoor stuff. And
Was that your kind of like you did the karting stuff, had to take the break, and then you started doing the car stuff. Was that how you got reintroduced back into karting? Was in sport karting in the indoor stuff?
So I'll tell you how that happened. I was running the 12-hour race at GPNY. So I was in charge of running the event. And so I met the names Dan Burke, Jordan Pembleton, mm-hmm. Fred Ogram, you know, mm-hmm. all of these guys.
Yeah. North
and
Carolina.
That's it. So it was a VLK yep. versus somebody else. And for whatever reason, I missed it. I'm the guy in charge of running the event, but Burke and Pembleton decided they wanted to take each other out or shove each other out of the way on the last corner of the last lap, and it was a position change. I think Pembleton got him. So, you know, they're all in my face going nuts. Da-da-da-da. Whose fault was this?
Those are, because I know back in the day, right. Those are two, when it comes to the heyday, and there was a heyday of the arrive and drive stuff, those are two of the biggest badasses in sport karting period of the time.
Right, yeah.
Burke was one of the first guys I know to do 12 of the 24 hours at VLK. And Pembleton was a top five world level guy. Mm-hmm. Again, sport karting stuff, but I bet you, and Burke has done more than just that, but yeah. two shoes and, yeah. and big
they
names.
Just happen to find each other on track. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No surprise. And so that happened. And I can't remember who it was. Ennis. I remember.
Yeah.
Ennis Bragg, right.
Hopefully he's listening in. Hey, Ennis. And Ennis had told me about the indoor championships in Arizona. He's like, come on over. This will be fun. Because we would do a thing, you know, beat the GPNY team at GPNY. And, I mean, that was my excuse to drive in the race, which was amazing. I'd wet the track down. And
that was a thing, yeah. At Grand Prix New York, it was one of the only places you'd actually have wet races there.
Yeah, we'd wet.
Crazy.
Stay with the slick tires on. They actually stopped doing that because I left the hose on during the night by accident and it flooded the building next door.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so I mean, we had a real wet track.
Was it your last day?
No, I made up some excuse to keep myself in there. Yeah, so I mean, that's how I found out about the Arizona thing, and then obviously met you there and chatted with you, and then decided to come do.
Yeah, and that wasn't, I mean, the Arizona thing wasn't until 2011.
11.
Yeah.
So I had been doing the GPNY stuff for about 2 years.
To backtrack a second, because this whole thing, the GPNY, you know, got you back into karting, but all that got kickstarted again because you're at Skip Barber, but you were doing coaching as well. Was that something that you were able to do through Skip Barber, or was it something that happened on your own? And also, how did you take to doing coaching?
Yeah, is this something you were always like, oh, I would like to be a coach at some point?
No, and I'll be honest, knowing what I know now and you know, the last 10 years for me, the money's made in coaching, to be quite honest. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to say you can be a great race car driver, not a very good coach, but you can also have the opposite. You can be a great coach and not a particularly good race car driver. And I think there's very few can do both. I'd like to think I'm one of the ones that can do both of them. And I've really spent a lot of time coaching clients. And whether that means it's a six-year-old in a go-kart, I still put the same time into what I would do, you know, with a 35-year-old driving a Porsche GT3 Cup car. And, you know, the coaching for me, I mean, I've learned the data. So, you know, the race cars now, we're pulling data from Motec or AIM and really going through it with a fine comb. And, you know, that for me is successful because there was a long time I would sit right seat coaching, fun as could be, absolute idiot. You know, sitting right seat was, you know, you're the other person's mercy, and not saying they're bad or good, but if even when a mistake happens, the pro is going to do something different from the am, or a failure.
Right.
So, you know, I did my years and had my scares, and the data really helped me, because that was a way of me showing the client, no, I can coach you from outside the car equally as well.
Right, right. So, and that's the thing, actually, in carts, right, is that a lot of times we can coach from the outside just by watching them get around the joint and then looking at the data at the same time. You don't need to necessarily do follow leader every time, especially when they're an adult. A lot of times, if you get the baseline of this is the line and how to get around the joint, we don't need to be out there. I mean, it does help to be able to go chase you down into the braking zone, see how fast you can go, sure. But the other plus side is you're driving your own ride there.
Yeah, not, I was going
to
say.
But
yeah.
It is nice to not always, it's not a requirement for that follow leader.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've done a lot of lead follow stuff. I'm sure you guys have as well. And it's very easy for the person to follow your tracks. Sometimes that's not a good thing. You
right,
know,
right.
You're following another car and they're not on the line, and all of a sudden you see the speed decrease and don't understand why. It's because they're following somebody that's line wasn't mm-hmm. correct. So, and there's new systems coming out now that is, you know, live in the car. A couple of customers that I have I'm working with, there's maybe a second or a 2 second delay in it. And I'm watching them around Sebring without really any mess up on the little iPad that I'm using. And that stuff is good because I can catch a mistake before it happens. You know, they miss an apex in turn one at Sebring. Hey, you better, we've got to tidy that up the next time. You know,
right.
Turn sooner or whatnot.
Instead of
waiting for a 20-minute session where they yeah. think they're doing a good job and adding more speed each time. And then all of a sudden, you know, we're off in the tire wall.
Yeah, that's awesome. So when we go back to making that adjustment from the barber stuff, right, so you're doing the barber thing. You're talking about 6, 7, 8. You're doing the skip barber stuff, the formula car, and you get the opportunity to start doing the GPNY thing. You see, doing that for a couple of years. As you say, the Arizona race. I met you in 2011. What's the progression there from barber into whatever's next? Because as you say, in 12, right, you had the Miata or the MX-5 opportunity. If you can, for us, bridge that gap there from the barber to the MX-5 and what was going on between there, and did you ever find a competition karting track in there as well?
So kind of similar deal to what I experienced in Scotland, where there was a gap where it was like, it's funding related, you know, I got to figure out how to get this dollar amount to go race in another series. An MX-5 cup at the time might have been $100,000, $75,000. I say it might have been because I never paid that, and I'll tell you why. But the part that I enjoyed was when the Skip Barber years ran out, I had made enough contacts that I drove an F2000 car at Road America, and we did really well. And then I drove an F2000 car at Lime Rock, and we finished second. And the opportunities kept coming up because the clientele that was coming through the doors at GPNY were all big racing uh-huh. enthusiasts. Mm. And I would have said, even at that point, if I wasn't going to go anywhere, I was really enjoying the coaching side of it. That I mean the amount of private lessons we did in there was through the roof. You know, we do one driver, two drivers, 10 drivers, and they'd rent the track for an hour or whatnot. And I really enjoyed that, but I knew that this, and it's funny because the scholarship owner Tim Sugden, he said, you got to meet as many people as you can, you know, you make people like you, make
yep.
you're the guy that they want to help. And not to overdo it, I just work with someone that's to the best of my ability, and if they take a liking to it, then, you know, maybe there's another step. If there's not, doesn't matter, you know, we'll keep working through.
Yeah, your job is still to do the coaching.
Yeah,
to be a good coach.
And, yeah, and if anything comes off of it, it's a bonus.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. But I liked it because the differences there was when I was working in a supermarket versus when I was working at a go-kart track. So I was always involved, even when I wasn't racing myself.
Right.
That, you know, I was going to a go-kart track and I was learning something. You'd see somebody do something on the racetrack, not saying they were any good, they would do something ridiculous. Oh, there's what happens when you do that at that particular corner. So the coaching has made myself a better driver as well, because you see people doing different things.
That's one of the things, actually, talking to another race car driver, Craig Stanton. He had told us that one of the nice things, like Derek and I were always at the racetrack. And even if you're not racing, being at the racetrack, doing the coaching or being around it, you're always engaged. Your brain is always seeing things happen, and you're even like an open practice day. It's not even your drivers or anything like that. For us, it's just we're just doing our jobs. But you're watching people go around the joint and you go, oh, you're a little wide. Oh, yeah. You could, oh, this, that, or whatever. Or it, you, as you say, you see something like that was wrong or this is why, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, 100%. It keeps you busy. I think Craig's here this weekend. I think I saw him in the paddock earlier as well. And I think he ran that year in 13 with us because it was the only time I was there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So and he was actually
take off early.
Yeah. He was on track for a Masters Championship, I believe, that same year. And he actually got an opportunity, believe it or not, with Mercedes when they were doing the black, right? Mm-hmm. With the black car, I think it was called black, the GT or the
AMG?
AMG black or something like that at the time. I think so.
But that sucked. Yeah, he had to miss Sunday. He took off Saturday night.
Because he got that opportunity. Yeah,
he was definitely here.
He's like, Steven, you go ahead and take care of this. I'm out of here.
I was like, okay, fine.
If I have to,
yeah,
right?
I guess so. Going back to GPNO, I mean, that was the time for me. I mean, it was barely making the rent payment. I'd take the train to work for a year and a half. I had a blow-up mattress. So I was kind of back to square one at 20 years old. But yeah, I have a degree in engineering management, which I got at college. So you said the years between my go-karting and my skip barber. I went to Bell College and I got an HND in product design and engineering management degree. And didn't want to use it, just wanted to drive their Formula SAE car.
Golly, isn't that how it works?
And that's how I get in there. And funnily enough, I never drove the car.
I've heard that story a few times too.
Yeah.
But I got the degree and it was my backup because obviously there's a lot of stuff racing related with that as well that maybe I could put that towards good use. But the driver stuff overtook the engineer stuff for me. I couldn't see myself going in an engineer, and I mean now there's a lot of engineering involved in the car and whatnot, but I wanted to be a driver. There was no question that was the direction I was going.
Were you during all this time, I mean you're working your butt off at the indoor track and like you just said, you're sleeping on the blow up mattress, was it mentally draining or did you feel like you had some good momentum behind you?
I really felt like I had good momentum. I mean honestly, I was the first person at work at 6 o'clock in the morning to get ready for a lesson. We'd do late night, we'd open both tracks and do super track and, a lot of the big names would come in and stuff. And I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed being there. Like it was getting to the point where it wasn't, okay, I was working 12, 14 hour days, but it wasn't. I was at the racetrack having fun.
Yeah.
And I was down, I remember picking up a form at the front desk. And I hear this lady saying, excuse me, could I get a waiver for my son or daughter, whatever it was at the time. And I look up and it's Catherine Zeta-Jones is staring directly at me.
Wow.
So I didn't say anything. I just kind of stared at her for like 10 seconds. And Mount Kisco is a super wealthy area. I mean, there was a lot of, or Bedford. Bedford Hills was where, a lot of the actors and whatnot stay. So I gave her the form, stared at her for another 10 seconds. And GPNY had a bar and a restaurant and my roommate at the time was down getting the bar and the restaurant ready for opening. And I come running down and I says, hey, Matt, you will not believe this. Like, Catherine Zeta-Jones is at the front desk. This woman is magnificent. And a guy on the end of the bar says, really? I'd believe she's here. And it was Michael Douglas was sitting at the end of the bar.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I was like, oh, face going glowing red. I was like, oh. So he was laughing.
Love your movies. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of momentum in there. I mean, a lot of guys helped me out financially to get, some opportunities. And then, from 12 to 16 was all Mazda stuff. And then again, the big jump was Joe Robillard giving me an opportunity. And it's kind of where we're at now.
When we're talking about the movement in the cars and like you said, you had the opportunity by meeting people and things like that. How did you get into sports cars and why that direction? You said that, again, there's a little bit of that gap. What was the getting back into the car opportunity? And why that? Because you just got done doing the sport or the barber stuff, right? Yeah. Open wheel. At that age, I would assume open wheel is going to be a challenge. So maybe it's more natural to go that direction. But how did you get that first opportunity in a car and what was it?
Well, I mean, I really was trying to get my hands on anything. So, I mean, I drove an F2000 car, like I had mentioned.
Right.
I just wanted to drive anything, even if it was a track day over here to learn Lime Rock or learn a track that I hadn't been to. When I won the scholarship in 05, Globecast Radio did an interview with me, and this was a thing back in the UK. And it was a guy called Declan Brennan and John Hinehaw. Well, John Hinehaw is the one that does all the commentating now for all the IMSA stuff.
Oh.
And we stayed in touch for a long, long time, the three of us. And I had, never met the two of them. And Declan Brennan had started working with C.J. Wilson Racing. C.J. Wilson was the Anaheim Angels baseball player.
Right. Yeah.
Obviously, and he had the big race team at the time. And Declan said, CJ is interested in trying you out at the 25 hours of Thunder Hill, which is, you know, the 25 hours and one of the most insane racetracks you've ever seen in your life, especially at night when it's snowing and dark. And I get a phone call to go over and do that. And I was teammates with Tyler McQuarrie, who's been a good friend of mine for a long time now. He's another California guy, Scottish guy. And we ran... Out of the 25 hours, Tyler did 11 and I did 10. And the other three guys split the remaining time. So it was amazing. I'd never driven I didn't think a Miata or it was an MX-5 at the time. I didn't think an MX-5 would give you a sore neck. But my neck was killing me after this.
Was that your first endurance race?
First endurance race and first ever time driving a sports car, period. I had never driven minus the minis and stuff that I had coming up through the scholarship. So,
and this is the tryout, right? This is the tryout for the...
Well, that's the best part. It wasn't even a tryout. It was an opportunity to drive at the 25 hours of Thunder Hill. I'm like, great, I can get a lot of seat time here.
Yeah.
Hopefully the team likes me. Hopefully I do a good job.
Sure.
And I get a phone call from CJ saying, hey, we didn't expect you to be as quick as that. What type of budget can you bring to the opening MX-5 Cup race? And... I asked a few friends, like we had a chat at dinner one night and they decided that they were going to put some money up. And I mean,
You didn't call?
It was Douglas? Catherine Zeta and Michael Douglas.
Yeah. Douglas? That,
yeah. Here's what we can do for you.
Hey, Catherine.
They missed out. They missed on the opportunity.
Yep. So, I mean, they gave me a tenth of the budget for the first race, but I think CJ was already going to put me in the car and I obviously didn't know that at the time. So I went out to Sebring, qualified pole, drove away from the whole field.
Do you remember what a tenth of the budget was? Just totally curious.
They wanted, I think, $10,000 for a race.
Okay.
So I got $1,000 just to show you. This was 10 guys putting in $100.
Right.
And that's that right there has got to feel awesome.
For sure.
I mean, you bring what you bring, but the support of people trying to see you get
there. No, exactly. And I had said, I was like, I think this is a good opportunity. And, you know, there was a $200,000 prize at the end of the year, but I wasn't thinking about it. I was like, let me go to Sebring. I did my Skip Barber racing school there. I raced Skip Barber Nationals 07 and 08, so I have plenty of time at Sebring. Let me go see if I can figure this out. And again, jumped in the car, and I actually remember the lap times and everything. I mean, I remember exactly what I was doing. It was stand and start at the time. And Chad McCombie, who's my partner at McCombie McAleer Racing, he was also in that race. And his sponsor at the time, Modspace, his partner, Modspace, was helping him get into sports car racing from the NASCAR side. So that's another connection on how that happened. So I won the race and came out of the championship. It was two races. I had a first and a seventh. I came out of the championship second. And they said, okay, well, we can't leave you hanging in second place here.
We don't really like runner-up people.
Yeah, exactly. Can you bring us any more money? I was like, no.
I really can't.
Already got my $100 off my guys. Like, you joking?
I don't have another 10 friends.
So at the time, there was a lot of prize money. And the prize money went to the team. CJ clearly took money out of his own pocket to help me.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward down the line. I won the championship, and I think there's only two drivers that ever won in their first attempt, so rookie of the year and champion. And then what I really enjoyed with this was, again, I had three teams I could pick from, as mentioned before, iMoto, Freedom, and CJ. And CJ's team, and it wasn't the staff, they were just behind. They were behind on the ST program compared to Freedom and iMoto. And at Lime Rock was the last race of the year. Freedom and iMoto were racing for the championship. And I think it was Tom Long versus Pierre Kleinubing, and Pierre won in the iMoto car. So my thought process on that was, all right, listen, I'm in with Mazda right now. I have my $200,000. I can pick whatever team I want. But the two teams that were just fighting for the championship there, if I join one of those teams, the expectation is easy. They're expecting me to win because the team is already at the top. Mm. So I went to CJ Wilson Racing, who was not at the top, and said, I want 2 years out of this. Let me come in here. Let me work with you guys and see if I can make the cars go faster. And I felt like I owed him a little as well, because he'd obviously helped out on the MX5 Cup stuff. And the second race in it, Circuit of the Americas, you know, we won the second race. So that was a really good, fun season. We won COTA, Watkins Glen.
And you say we, that's you and...
Mark Miller.
Mark Miller.
Mark Miller was my teammate at the time. So we won two races. Probably could have won some more. Not going to lie, if I didn't tell you, I made some mistakes that year. And but that was my first year ever racing in a multi-manufacturer series. You know, we were up against... Right. Honda, Nissan, I don't think Audi was in it at the time, but the cars had different performances. And the Mazda was amazing at Lime Rock. It was amazing at Laguna Seca, but you would go to Road America and I'm on the radio saying every word possible, saying this is a joke because we're on the straight and, you know, they're flying past me on the straightaway.
Yeah. You got to get your lap time in the twisty bits.
That's it. So, you know, again, from started to get the experience, okay, well, we're not good at Road America, so don't push the car. I don't need to go off the racetrack here. I don't need to dive bomb this guy because he's going to go flying past me on the next straight.
You burn your stuff up, yeah.
Drive around and we'll finish higher than we should. But when we get to Lime Rock, different story. We'll qualify on pole and we'll try and win that race. And then we won the championship 2015 ST.
Everything you've come into so far, you've come in pretty hot, whether it was the, you know, maybe not the first time in a go-kart, but, you know, everything else after that, like, you've got into, you've been fast right away. I think it's safe to say, Mike, and you might agree too, it's been a natural talent that you've had. As you've gotten older, and, you know, I want to talk more about the coaching down the road, because when I was getting coached by Mike in my younger days, he was like, there's natural and there's learned. He goes, and you are learned. You're figuring this out as you go. You being a natural, it sounds like, and getting into all this, I mean, did you really know what you were doing, or do you have to really take time to dissect what you were doing to have feedback?
I mean, obviously, when I was the earlier days, I'll give you a perfect example. So my teammate was Elliot Skier, and he was the Mazda shootout winner. And he was my teammate during the first weekend at Sebring. So to be quite honest, it was all on him. Meaning he was the guy, he was the new kid on the block. He had the Mazda speed suit, he had the Mazda helmet. You know, ran in NorCal and did all the SCC Spec Miata stuff. And I remember coming in after the first practice session, and I was by all means not the fastest in the first practice. I was, you know, 10th or 11th, and he was right up top. And I remember him saying to the engineer, let's change this, let's change this, let's change this. And I'm like, whoa, you can change setup on these things? Yeah. I thought these were spec. Yeah. Know, I don't know. Jesus, the guy's changing tone.
They gave me the steering wheel and let go.
Yeah. I'm like, okay. So immediately I'm like, well, maybe I can learn something from this guy. Well, that whole weekend I got faster as a driver. He started questioning what he was doing on the setup stuff because I was getting closer and we really didn't change anything. So I had no feedback. I wasn't able to say the car is doing this, the car is doing that.
Right.
You know, okay, you're 2/10 off in sector one. Okay.
Well, drive harder. Right,
yeah, thanks. You know,
yeah.
Drive. Thanks a lot. I'll go faster next time. Now it's a different story with experience. I mean, I jump in the car and, you know, within three corners on an outlap, I'll tell you what we need to make change-wise, you know, pretty confident. Even here that I've never been here before, take me a couple of laps to get used to it.
For sure.
And then I can start dissecting the car and figuring out what we need to change.
Give me more steering in the final corner. I'm pretty sure it's going to be the
highly
first.
Highly possible. I'm glad it has power steering.
Yeah. Oh, buddy. Don't jinx it, mate.
Yeah, see?
But for the Mercedes, like this weekend, because of the issue that you're having just that one corner, could you tell them, like, hey, let's change the damn wheel?
Can you even do that?
Like, no, I don't think so,
because,
right?
You know, these, all the shit in the
well,
in
these
the
cars now, GT3, GT4, they're all built from the manufacturer.
Right.
You go back to the ST days, Well, the ST Mazdas were built by Andrew Slavens, who was CJ's guy. He built them in his workshop. You know, took an MX-5 and built it. Compass built their Hondas.
Right.
These things, no, you cannot. You can't change anything on them. Yeah. You can't. If you change the wheel, they look at that as it's out of spec. And guess what? You're getting DQ'd when you've got a big, massive wheel like a NASCAR on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're getting bounced in tech.
Get the old elbow.
Do the other GTD GTD cars have that same butterfly style?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Man.
And I was laughing. Like, I mean, the corner is just so tight. I'm not worried that it's going to be an issue. I mean, I'd be worried if, you know, there's a DPI car makes a move last minute or somebody does try and throw a move down the inside. You have to take the ego out of the equation at that time. You can't try and hang on around the outside because you're just going to drive into the wall. So it's going to be a...
Physics is going against you, mate.
Yeah, it's a very easy corner to defend on. You know, just by missing the left curb a little on the entry.
You just move over a tire width and the doors close.
Yes, I'm not too worried about that.
Looking at last year, I think it was on the start, they're coming out of the for IndyCar, they're coming out of that corner and like Herta gets hit in the back and like saves it or whatever, but you know, butterfly wheel too, he catches it, but his hand's over and the wheel's upside down and you see him slamming the gear back and like just trying to get the thing back to first. I'm like, that looks like a mess, man.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it was last year or a couple of years ago, but there was a picture of two Corvettes, a BMW.
Oh, yeah, parking lot.
Actually, it must have been longer than that because the Ford GT was in at the time. But
yeah,
there was six cars all facing the wall. They were all, you know.
Because once the first one goes and it doesn't make it, the rest of them are stuck.
Well, now you can't make it.
Yeah.
So I was laughing. I said to the team, I was like, just remind me where the reverse button is on this car because I don't know where it is.
Yeah, they haven't had to use it.
Maybe I'll need it.
The only place you will, maybe. Yeah. That was part one of the Fullcaster podcast, episode 45 of Stephen McAleer. Be sure to catch part two as well.